hold leaders accountable. Our healthcare system will only get better, and new innovations that scale will only improve healthcare if we hold people accountable to making sure that those innovations don't make healthcare worse for other people or don't drive up costs. And so I think it's important that we don't just recognize it within our own work, but that we hold others to a higher standard.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. In this episode, my guest, investor, founder, and entrepreneur Holly Tecco, talks about the importance of becoming bilingual to innovate in healthcare. And she doesn't mean English and Spanish. She means bilingual in healthcare and technology. Innovation needs both. It's just one of the gems Holly shares in her brilliant new book, Massively Better Healthcare. Others, spend time with believers, not detractors. Become a true anthropologist of the problem you're looking to solve and get your voice in the room when policy is being shaped. We recorded this conversation live at UC Berkeley School of Public Health with an audience of students and Bay Area innovators, which means we also caught the background sounds of ambulances, reminding us what's at stake. So please welcome Holly Tecco to The Other 80. So wonderful to have you here. I wish I could spend the whole time on podcast tips and tricks, but we're not going to do that. Holly's an amazing podcaster. If you don't already listen to her show, you should definitely do that. And I always start my show with a question, which is, what should people know about you?
I reluctantly left the Bay Area. And when I see breathtaking views like this, it's so hard to not want to come back. But I really launched my career in the Bay Area, and I owe a lot of the success that I've had and the success of the organizations that I've run because this community is unparalleled. It's the volume of people that are dedicated to making change. There are more investors here, more funding. It's easier to hire employees, and everybody just has a sense of hopefulness that is like super infectious. So I'm so happy to be back. This is my very last stop in San Francisco. I've been here for a few weeks now, and it's just been so great to connect with everyone that I've worked with throughout the years. And I've also made some new friends.
And welcome back anytime. I mean, we welcome you back.
I live in London now, though. So
you do?
I do.
I live in New York.
Yes. No, I'm in London. Okay. I moved to London last year, and the flight is so long.
Yeah, okay. I just got back from Taipei this morning, so I'm super sympathetic about this. I remember I met you, Ryan Panchatsaram, and Sean Duffy in about the same period of time. I was working with Ryan at the White House with Todd Park, but I remember so distinctly coming to your offices in Chinatown when it was still just a few people, and the structure now has been replicated many times, but it was really quite novel and new.
Yeah.
And I'd love to have you pull out that story of why you started Rock Health and what you saw that was needed at that time.
Yeah, I love that you went to the Chinatown office. We were there for maybe 2.5 years. So it was a really special time, and only certain people experienced that office. And it was the cheapest office we could find, as you could imagine. And we had a Chinese landlord, and my dear friend Erica helped us negotiate a really good rate. We were above an antique store and below a temple. And it just had so much charm and a sense of resourcefulness, I think. But why did I start Rock Health? So, and I do tell this story in the book and kind of the first opening chapter, which I call, "Who Are You to Do This?" Because that was a question that I got from one of the early investors that I pitched the idea to in Boston. My co-founder, Nate Gross, and I, we were in business school. We worked on this business plan for Rock Health for the whole year. And we started pitching investors and corporations to fund this ambitious idea we had to be the first Y Combinator for healthcare is what we were calling it. H Combinator was a code name we used for a while. I'm so glad we didn't end up with that. But we didn't get enough enthusiasm and support in Boston, which is why we came here. And I had lived in San Francisco before business school and had friends here, wanted to be in the Bay Area, but really it was because our early supporters were here and they listened to the idea and said, okay, this could maybe work. And so that was kind of the genesis for Rock Health. And being very scrappy, we started with just a few $100,000, gave most of it away to startups and had to figure out how to kind of keep the lights on. So over the years, we started adding on different programming. We started creating the first and longest now longitudinal database of digital health funding. So every company that's ever been funded since 2010 when we started the database, any startup that's been funded for over $2 million. So we have a threshold because you can't get every tiny seed deal, and started doing things like publishing reports and data around the trends that was happening in the space. We started hosting events and doing whatever we felt like the community needed and would help support founders and also help us keep the lights on.
In the book, it mentions my old colleagues Anish Chopra and Todd Park, who, if you've ever met them and seen, especially, well, both of them on stage, they have an infectious energy. And I think really pointed out how these big problems in healthcare really needed the innovator's touch. And of course, Todd had founded Athena Health before then and Castlight. You're a serial founder. You're an investor. You also had this really important play, Rock Health, which is an ecosystem builder.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, looking back on those different junctures, what are the patterns you see now that you didn't see then?
Well, we're in a completely different world today than we were when we started Rock Health. There were very few examples of companies that have scaled within digital health. And we certainly didn't have a lot of consumer-facing options. Healthcare at the time, I remember we had to pay, what, $35 billion in incentives to get doctors to use EHRs. There was like a lot of coaxing that had to happen in order to get the healthcare industry up to speed. But what has been remarkable is that since then, we now are seeing healthcare systems as some of the most innovative groups adopting AI faster than other segments in the economy. Is it okay that there's sound? Okay.
It'll be atmospheric, right?
Yes. We are downtown Berkeley. And so it's been so exciting because now, and I think a lot of it was because of COVID. And what happened was we were forced to adopt technology for things like virtual care and virtual clinical trials, and it had to happen quickly. And so progress that would have otherwise taken many, many, many years, we saw happen in weeks. And I think what happened is a lot of these health leaders, healthcare system leaders, and I've talked to some of them, they very quickly, they're so smart and resourceful, and they're used to working under a lot of constraints. They built out capabilities to assess what they need and adopt it quickly. And all of a sudden, what followed was a culture shift. Teams were a little bit less reluctant to try new things, and it's completely night and day. And so when I say that now, you know, hospitals are the leaders, we are literally seeing 2.2 times faster adoption of healthcare systems than anywhere else in the economy, according to a Menlo Ventures report last year. So that's incredible to see. Now we are like tech leaders. Never would have thought that would happen, but here we are.
And it's not just transcription and note-taking, right?
No, I mean, we're seeing, okay, I mean—
although there is a lot of that.
There's a lot of that. I mean, ambient scribes are now, you know, ubiquitous. Clinical documentation is now ubiquitous, which is cool to see. But we're also seeing things like what was just announced in Utah, which is AI prescribing for refills, for medication refills. And I think that is going to continue to progress very, very quickly.
I love the outside-in principle. So
work from the inside out.
Inside out. I said it the wrong way. Inside out, I think, really is an attempt to say, if you come in with a lot of bravado and a lot of, you know, I came up with a new idea and you have to adopt it, it's not going to work. And so you really need to be the anthropologist you described.
Yes.
At the same time, I would say, and this is something I asked Mark Cuban when I talked with him recently on the podcast, what makes him so brave? And he paused and he kind of laughed. And he said, I'm not brave. And I said, well, you're pretty bombastic anyway. And he said, no, here's the thing. I refuse to be part of the system I want to change. So I'd love to have you pull those threads. What does it mean to be inside out, but not to be kind of mindset captured by the system you're trying to change?
Yeah.
How do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have today a lot of people who are bilingual in both technology and healthcare. When I was starting, there were healthcare people and there were tech people, and they never talked to each other. They never went around the table. The healthcare people were very unwelcoming to tech people and outsiders, and tech people thought they knew everything. And so what I noticed was that people coming in from the outside would often say, I have this great solution, I'm just going to apply it to healthcare, without really understanding the problem. And so the word I use in the book and the word I really like about it is, it's much better to become an anthropologist of healthcare, at least of the corner you're trying to change. You don't need, and there's no way you could understand all of healthcare. But the problem that you're trying to solve, focus on understanding and becoming an expert in that problem. And there are going to be a universe of solutions that are possible. In fact, that universe of solutions will change as new technologies and new pathways to reimbursement become available. So be flexible on the solution, but just stay focused on continuing to understand your problem really well. Okay, and then the other side, we have healthcare people who are deep into the problem on an everyday basis, but they might not have as much savviness of what are the new technologies, what are the new business models, what are the new strategies. They might not have the time to understand that. And so they also need to do some work before jumping to conclusion of what solution will solve this problem of understanding the universe of solutions. If you're not bilingual, that's fine. Spend time understanding the other piece of it and just focus on knowing your stakeholder, studying the problem that they face, even better if you yourself are a stakeholder. Some of the best companies in digital health are those that were founded by people who were part of, they wanted to solve the solution for themselves.
I love the story you had about the Virta founders. This was a person who developed prediabetes and actually rode across the Pacific.
From San Francisco to Hawaii.
Fundraising for new dietary standards, yeah. And then founded Virta, which many of you know is a really groundbreaking company, yeah, working on metabolic syndrome and other, yeah, things. One of the things you describe in the book is the sweet spot where, mm-hmm, profit and purpose can align. Yes. And there are many places in healthcare where that does not happen. You were the first investor in Sean Duffy and his company, Omada Health, and he really exemplifies for me,
yes,
that principle of purpose and profit aligning.
Yeah.
His company just went public. People are wondering how to replicate that for other companies. I'm wondering what something he really nailed when he was starting his company.
Yeah.
Because if you start off on the wrong foot, it's really hard to retrace your steps.
Yes. He did not accept the status quo of the PMPM payment model within employer benefits. So for those that aren't familiar with that term, per member per month is generally the formula that employers will use to pay for a solution. So no matter how many people would use it, they would pay a flat amount, and then it's up to the company to work on utilization, right? It's a burden of the company. And it's a pretty straightforward payment model, and it's a nice, like, for HR to check the box, like, oh yeah, we offer this. Like, we'll just offer it. It's X amount for us total because we're looking at the whole population. But that doesn't mean that the product's going to work. And so what Sean Duffy did was that I want to build something that will actually work for people with prediabetes to reverse it so they don't develop diabetes. So a virtual care program for prediabetes. But I only want to get paid if we're successful, which means that we're putting our company at risk. But that also means that we're aligned with creating a great product that works. And we need to show outcomes that way. We can't just get by on the PMPM model. And so we really bet the entire business on creating a new model that really didn't exist in the employer world at the time. He also, to his credit, he created a whole new CPT code for prediabetes care, which didn't exist before. So again, someone who did not accept the status quo of how healthcare worked. And there are some things that are not changeable. You and I know this very well. But where there are opportunities to change and change the way things are paid for, if you can do that, I think it's very worthwhile. And you can create just a ripple effect in the entire industry, like Sean did.
And he dropped out of medical school. I'm not recommending anyone do that necessarily, but he felt like he could make more impact through the company, which of course now hindsight's 2020. It looks like a good decision. In the book you talk about, I would say this is one part of the book where I was arguing with you a little bit. It was the section where you talk about regulation, and you said that in many cases, and I think high tech is an example of this, new policies often get captured by the incumbents.
You disagree with that?
Because I also think that regulation and funding creates new market opportunities. I think both are true.
Both are true. I agree with that.
So I wanted to push on that intersection. What are the conditions?
But I think that it often disproportionately benefits the incumbents that have their fingerprints all over those policies.
But I also think often the perspective that government is mostly a limit on your business rather than an opportunity, I think has people not looking as closely as they should at the government opportunities.
I agree with that. And I do talk a lot about these inflection points, and one big inflection point being policy and really having your finger on the pulse of what's happening in DC in healthcare and specifically on what you're working on, because it can open up huge opportunities for new businesses that couldn't exist before. It can also do the opposite though, right? A sign of a policy could put some businesses out of business. And we might see that very soon with some large vertically integrated players in our space. I would say what I spent a lot of time on when writing this book and understanding better was the burden of regulatory capture and how incumbents have over the decades become so big because they're lobbying. Healthcare is the biggest lobbyist in DC. And this is not charity. They're not giving their money to politicians to be nice. They're giving money to politicians because there is an ROI on that. They give every year, year after year. They would not do that if they didn't benefit from those donations. I think we need to remove money from politics altogether. I don't know if
that'll be the next book.
Yes, that'll be my next book.
It sometimes feels, if you're starting out, like everything's already been invented and that there's no new opportunities for innovation and growth. What do you see as some of the biggest white spaces right now?
I don't know if I agree with that. I do think that there are areas where there are more innovators than other areas, but I think that healthcare still has so much opportunity for change that I think more competition is only good. Competition is helpful for keeping companies innovative, bringing down prices. So I'm a fan of more competition and not saying, oh, don't do anything in that area because there are a lot of companies, but like, are there still unmet needs? And most places within healthcare, there are still many, so many unmet needs. Maybe not GLP-1s. I feel like we have enough ways
enough
to get
of
those.
That.
Oh my
right.
gosh. But for the rest of healthcare, I think the most important thing is I don't think going out and searching for a problem is necessary. I think you can find problems that you've experienced as a patient with a human body that will be the best driver, because it is extremely hard. We have some healthcare founders in the room. It is extremely hard to be a founder. It is 10 times harder to be a founder on healthcare. It takes longer to succeed. And it's just, you're working on what I think are the most important problems that we will be able to solve, but it's also really challenging. And so making sure that you're picking a problem that you're genuinely very passionate about solving that will help drive you and be your North Star when things get inevitably very, very hard.
We have some student founders in the room.
Yeah.
We also have people that their heart's moving in that direction, but they don't yet feel like they have the thing that is going to keep them up at night that they really want to work on.
Then don't rush it.
Yeah.
Don't rush it.
So you would wait until you felt that way.
Yeah, I would spend more time becoming an anthropologist. Maybe work at a couple of companies, get to know different areas of healthcare really well, find what makes you excited about healthcare, where you see big opportunities for change, and spend time there. And then the idea will come to you, but you don't want to rush it because startups are 80 hours a week of your life.
Yeah.
If you just pick something haphazardly, you could end up, in a situation where you're spending time and you're tied to something you're not really passionate about. Could be a mess. So don't
rush
it.
We do have a very strong startup bent at this university. So I think,
of course.
Especially in, I think some people feel like that's what they should be doing right away.
I was talking to a Stanford professor a few weeks ago, and he was saying the biggest problem they have are students dropping out because they all want to start companies and the university is so lenient. They allow them to drop out and it's becoming a problem. And then no one wants to work at these companies because everybody wants to start a company.
We all have had the feeling of not being enough. And when that feeling intersects with the idea of starting a company where so many people are going to be telling you that that's not a good idea, like you did early on.
I still face that, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes.
How have you navigated? Because you want to be open to criticism. You want to be open to the feedback. But you also want to have the grit and chutzpah to move forward.
Yeah.
And especially for people that are just starting out, what are practices that you've developed or that you'd recommend to build that confidence engine while also remaining really open to feedback?
Yeah. I'm so sensitive. People like, you know, insult my baby. Like my first one-star review, I'm probably going to hyperventilate. I take things very
look
personally.
At the reviews.
I know, I can't. I take things very personally. And so that has been something throughout my career when I'm rejected or someone, you know, doesn't like my ideas. I take it really personally. And honestly, I'm married to someone who's the opposite. Could care less about what anyone thinks. A funny example is there was a work dinner he had to go to the other night. And he goes, I don't know if I feel like going. And I was like, just tell him like your wife's not feeling well. He goes, I'll just tell them I don't feel like going. I was like, oh, yeah.
Option.
You know what I mean? I was like, oh yeah, that's an option. And like, we had a good laugh about it. I think that's like, it was just very telling about our personalities. And I really do try to channel it because he's been a successful entrepreneur. And a lot of that is just like really knowing how to move forward, how to align yourself with those that see your vision. And my co-founder at Rock Health the same way. Nate was the same way. And he said to me, and I share this in the book, like, we just need to focus on the believers. Put it out of your mind. Many people are going to disagree with you. And once you're successful, you can look back and give them a little smirk. It is very satisfying. That is very satisfying to do. But I think that spending time, and I have to remind myself this still to this day, like spending time worrying about the naysayers versus that time can be so much better spent with people who align with your vision, believe in what you're doing, and want to be part of it.
I love that. You talked about the bilingual people in healthcare and tech.
Yeah.
So I think in healthcare, that can take lots of different forms. You could be a product person that's also clinical, right? You could be a salesperson that also knows how to do population health.
Yeah.
You could be a researcher that understands marketing. What are some dyads you would describe as really amazing combinations that set people up well to be innovators and founders?
Yeah, I see so many public health folks going into product. And I think that's great because to actually build something that people will use takes an approach that you have to understand research, you have to understand, you know, trial and error. And so I think that's a great combo. And there are plenty of opportunities now with AI. It's easier than ever to build things. So you don't even have to have necessarily a huge developer team. I think actually the product person who's responsible for building, testing, iterating is going to become even more important.
Interesting. They're not being replaced by AI?
The product managers? No, I think there's definitely still room for someone who's like shepherding a product from concept through the different iterations. It's the developers that are being replaced.
Which is interesting because I think that wasn't the case 5 or 10 years ago.
That's no, I mean, even 6 months ago, I feel like it wasn't, it really wasn't the case. And now we're hearing from developers that are like, well, this is better than me. See ya.
My son took a product role right out of college and now he's a founder. So
okay.
To your point. This is a really tough job market, especially for MPH students, where we're getting the double, triple whammy of cuts from the federal government, cuts to local and state, the attacks on equity and on public health as a field. At the same time, there are so many amazing things to work on. What advice would you give the students in the room that are entering the job market this spring who are facing all of these onslaughts of issues?
Yeah. I still think there's a ton of opportunity at startups, and we're seeing some of the best job growth in that part of the job sector, especially AI, for better or worse. But I think that being someone who's fresh out of school, that's like willing to learn, like what a interesting place to kick off your career or do your next career move. And being in the Bay Area, you have all these huge companies that continue to hire and grow, especially within healthcare.
You characterize the MPH students and the MBA students. And yes. What a recount what that was.
So I'm a dually, but I did them 10 years apart. So I got my MBA first and MPH second, which I think is usually the opposite. I mentioned in the elevator that what I found the difference between the two groups when I was getting my MBA, I found that all the students, my colleagues, focused on wanting to be liked. A lot of dialogue, a lot of debate, but it was very respectful and it was all about kind of building respect and credibility within the classroom. And then when I got my MPH, I felt like the students and the program I was in was very clinical heavy. It was about a third clinicians. They didn't really care about being liked. They wanted to be right. And so the debates, the conversations were just like all a little bit sharper and more direct and more about being right than anything else.
Being right in the sense of the data is going to show what's right or being right in the sense of one's ego or both?
Probably both. Yeah.
I just spent a couple days with these two amazing Nobel laureates. And I was really reminded that in some ways, the discovery process for products is so similar to the scientific process, where if you love the process and love the fact that you're going to learn and grow and let the testing guide the decision making, you're going to be so much better off than if you fall too in love with your idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I say about finding healthcare problems to work on.
But it's easier said than done because we get attached to our ideas.
We do.
What's a mistake you made super early in your career that shaped how you operate?
Ooh, many, many. But I would say the biggest one, I think, was I just fell prey to the work hustle culture that is very prominent here in Silicon Valley. And I worked too much and I pushed my team to work too much 7 days a week in the office through dinner at the expense of putting my own personal health and my relationships as second priority. And that wasn't because I was forced to. I mean, it was my thing. No one was telling me to. I was just like so obsessed with solving these problems and working on things and had tons of energy. I came to an inflection point when my dad, who lives in Ohio still, had a heart attack. I got a call. He was in the hospital. And I was like, okay, I'll come home like maybe next week. I have some like important investor meetings. And I didn't go home. And then he fortunately got better. And I just never went home because he was able to get better. And then he was discharged. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And reflected on that and was like, who have I turned into that like, and I was raised by a single dad. We're very close. And so I was like, who have I become where I'm not going home? Like, what is this meeting that is so important? And that's actually when we left the Bay Area and decided that that was, it was in 2015 that was, it wasn't bringing out the best in my work-life balance. And so decided I needed to extract myself from San Francisco.
Would you say that today? Do you think that's still the
case? Oh my gosh, no. I mean, I when I founded Natalist, I promised my husband that we had a young kid at the time. And I promised him that I would do it differently and that I'd stop work every day at 5. And I truly stuck with it. And our team was mostly moms. And we really prided ourselves on not pinging each other at night. I think there were probably two times when we worked after 5 o'clock. One was when we were trying to close a deal at Target, and one was when we were selling the company. And other than that, we really, really stuck to it. It's because it came from me. We came from, you know, if the founder and CEO is creating these boundaries, then it gives everyone else the okay to create those boundaries. So I always tell the founders that I work with how important it is that you do things like go see your therapist, go get your teeth cleaned, go do all of these like routine things that founders tend to put on the back burner and put it on your calendar and let everyone know you're doing those things. Or if you have kids, you know, say, oh, my kid's baseball game, this is something I have to do. And so it's not just doing it, but making sure that everybody sees you do it. So you give them that implicit permission to also make those other things a priority in your life.
And unfortunately, hustle culture is back.
It is back. It really is back.
Big time.
Yeah. We got better for a while, and then now it really
seems. And I think AI and the feeling of time, and if I don't move now, I feel like that's really
a sense of urgency that like it comes from a good place. It comes from like a real place. Like it's usually from there's so much to do and I'm enjoying it. It's easy to prioritize work above all else, but it's not sustainable.
I'm so glad you made that decision.
Yes.
And founded a successful company with new rules, new culture. Thinking about all of these amazing students in the room, if you wanted them to take one action away from reading the book, what would it be?
Hold leaders accountable. Our healthcare system will only get better, and new innovations that scale will only improve healthcare if we hold people accountable to making sure that those innovations don't make healthcare worse for other people or don't drive up costs. And so I think it's important that we don't just recognize it within our own work, but that we hold others to a higher standard.
What would that look like?
That would look like saying no to a job that is at a company where you feel like they're making healthcare worse, or pushing back or not becoming a customer of a company that you feel like isn't aligned with the vision of healthcare that you believe in.
Thank you, Hallie, so much for
joining. Thank you. This was fun.
Since Hallie founded Rock Health, wave after wave of innovators have hit the streets. And she was such a big part of that movement. From launching one of the first health incubators to narrating the development of the entire sector. But the innovation landscape can sometimes feel pretty dissonant. We have cool new companies offering much needed products, but when we need healthcare, when we seek healthcare, the system still seems pretty broken. So I really appreciated her closing thoughts, even though it is easier said than done. We need to demand accountability. If a product or company is not aligned with our vision of health, turn down that job and don't use their products. If collective action is all that's ever worked to change political regimes, could the same be true for healthcare? This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Hallie Tecco and her book, Massively Better Healthcare. There's more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.